It is 7:30, time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Reverend Rich Lang. He is a pastor with Trinity United Methodist Church in Ballard. Rich, thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
You have written an article entitled George Bush and the Rise of Christian Fascism that was forwarded to me, and I found fascinating, and that's going to be what the bulk of what we're talking about today. I'm wondering if we can begin with you telling us, what do you see as Christian fascism?
Well, the paper began as a talk, and what I was attempting to do is get some clarity about, you know, what's happening to the country, and originally it was written about a year ago. And again, being a pastor, I'm particularly concerned with what's this use of religious rhetoric. And I know that in the course of political history, presidents have used religious rhetoric all the time. I mean, it kind of goes part and parcel. You have to legitimate your policies through some means of transcendence, and usually pulling God into the picture helps anybody that wants to push something on folks. But this administration seemed to be doing it on steroids, so to speak. And so I started thinking about what is the popularity behind Bush. And in particular, I can probably give a quick story. In particular, within my own family structure, with people that I respect and love and care for, people who I think are, you know, reasonably good thinkers, moderate people, sometimes, you know, a little conservative, but not obnoxiously so. But they were loving this guy. They absolutely were loving George Bush. They were loving his rhetoric, his, quote, his moral leadership, and so forth. And so I decided to try to give some thinking to that. And what I believe is happening in the country is and it's been happening for quite a while, and I think that 9/11 certainly accelerated this, is that there is a growing linkage of all the spheres of power into one. And, you know, the genius of being of American democracy, the experiment here, is that power is diffused. So that if you have a strong presidency, you know, you might have a balanced Congress. You know, you'll have Democrats and Republicans, and they check each other. And then the judicial will even check them, and the press will check them, and even the church will check them. And business, it has its agenda, and labor and union. Well, I think what we're seeing is the fusion of all of that power under one ideology. And I began to think in terms of fascism. You know, you put nationalism on top of that, and especially after 9/11, there's the scent of racism in the air. But underneath all of that was this religious rhetoric. And so what I'm calling Christian fascism is that I think that there is a growing movement in this country that fuses the right-wing church, and we get into that a little bit more, along with this political movement, this neoconservative political movement, which I think is very anti-democratic in orientation. I think it's very fascist in orientation. And you fuse these two together, and that's what I'm calling Christian fascism. And, of course, I suppose my area of greatest concern is, okay, what's happening to the church and all of that. But I'm also a citizen in this country, and I'm seeing the political results, and you know, I got two sons at home, 15 and age 15 and 11, and I think that generation is going to pay a heavy cost for this particular administration and shift in the American psyche.
So I think our regular listeners would be familiar with the concept of neoconservatives in the White House, in outside the White House as well. And we often hear of people talking about the far right and far right Christian movement, but there's never any specifics on it. So can you tell us a bit about what makes up this movement? Are we talking about, for instance, like Pat Robertson? Would he be part of that?
I'll start with an audacious claim, and I say this in my talk. I think the future of this country revolves around who controls the interpretation of Scripture, of what's commonly called the Old Testament and New Testament. And, you know, we're supposedly a secular country, but I think to help people put their minds around it, the voice, the moral voice of rhetoric, of religious rhetoric in this country, I think is either going to go the way of a Pat Robertson or the way of a Martin Luther King. And what I see is that the Robertson wing is on the rise. And what that wing is all about goes something like this. In any scripture, and certainly in the Christian and Judeo scriptures, there are always layers of meaning. And you know, you can almost find anything you want in there, because it's written by you know, over a long period of time by different people in different situations. And within the Bible, there are narratives which I would call holy war narratives, and that is this whole notion that calls forth the righteous warrior to purge evil out of the land. And it's a moral development, because you know, something is happening in society that is frightful and fearful, and it's causing chaos and terror, and people are dying. And so in reaction to that, religious legitimation is given for violence. And the religious person will, without guilt, without shame, with the kind of conscience that can sleep well at night, will be given permission to purify the land for the good of all, even the good of the enemy that you're purifying. And that's what I call the holy war narratives that are embedded in some of the scriptures. Those are the narratives that the Bush administration and the religious right wing in this country are really drawing on in a very powerful and in a very new way, I think. And I'll give some examples of that in a minute. The other narrative, the one that Martin Luther King drew on, and I would say Jesus drew on, is what you call the prophetic narrative. Throughout Scripture, there is a storyline that is against empire. It's against the accumulation of power. And the prophetic critique of power, the one that says to the king, we need to limit your ability, that just because you make a decision doesn't mean that that has to be the rule of law, so to speak. And so the prophets arose to critique the exploitative business practices and the overreaching of power by the king, so to speak. And Jesus comes out of that tradition, and he speaks of compassion and mercy and inclusivity and welcoming the sinner, welcoming the unclean, because that's the way to peace, is you create a relational economy and you create a relational politics that reaches out and embraces the concerns of the least among them. Mr. Bush and the Bush administration use Jesus, but then redefine his message through holy war narratives, which Jesus never drew upon. The importance of this is, I think that's what's happening. One of the major conflicts in the church throughout this country is which narrative is going to rule the pulpit. And what we're hearing, the media expression of Christianity, is almost entirely this holy war narrative of purity. And it's driven by two branches. One that I think is very familiar to people, especially those who have ever seen these Left Behind books in stores. One is this apocalypticism. And what that means is that's a catastrophic, we're living in catastrophic times. The world is about to come to an end. But there is it's kind of like Freud's Thanatos syndrome. There's actually a desire for the world to come to an end, because it's become so impure and things are so chaotic and people are so unrighteous that what needs to happen is a huge purifying of the land. The media expression of Christianity and many evangelical and fundamentalist churches are drawing upon these narratives that we are living in the end times. It's a theology of despair. How that translates, to give a case example, is why bother with the environment? Because we're not going to be around in 100 years. And so it's just not that important to create and build a sustainable society. Another way that translates, that I think, again, might be familiar to many folks because it's in the media, and that's this absolute marching in lockstep with the hard right of Israel. There can be no critique of Israeli-Palestinian relationships, and nor is there linkage with the church in America and the church in Palestine. Rather, it's a wedding between the right wing in this country and the right wing in Israel. Doesn't matter what Israel does to the Palestinian people, because in Christian right-wing rhetoric, Israel, the scenario they've painted that is for the end times, is that the Jews have to be in their land, they have to be in political control of their land, the temple needs to be rebuilt in their land, which means that, you know, any day now we might see the self-fulfilling prophecy of the mosque on the Dome of the Rock destroyed. Now, that would just electrify the right-wing church. They would think that Jesus is coming back any minute once that happens. And these are practical political implications of a religious worldview that is being pushed amongst, what, close to 40 million Americans that attend these right-wing churches. That Christian apocalypticism is being wedded with another form of theology called dominionism. And in a nutshell, what we can say about that is that's the notion that Christians are elected by God to have dominion over the governments of the world. We are to rule, in other words. Christians are to rule by force, if necessary, for the good of all. And, you know, that's, again, we can talk about that a bit more. That's not only, you know, just political philosophies and economic philosophies, but in particular, that's moral philosophies. And the impure, the immoral, again, get your mind around this, think homosexuals, need to be eradicated for the good of all. And this is right-wing Christian belief in this country, and not only in this country, but around the world. And it's the Christianity that is growing. It's a mirror image of the Taliban, you know, the Islamic fundamentalism. And so, I think what we're seeing across the world in our culture and throughout cultures is a growing crisis of faith. You know, does the world have a future, and what does that future look like?
Is it fair to call it, to lump all the right-wing Christians into this, though? I mean, it seems to me it's more extreme right-wing.
Sure. I mean, because you always start with the elites, and the elites are, you know, you get some, you put money behind, you know, particular people that can voice and articulate an extreme version of this, but then it really does trickle down. And this, you know, for example, lots of folks have Christians in their families, their extended families or friendships, and right-wing Christians, and they might say, well, you know, we've heard a little bit of this, but we really don't believe this. But it begins to trickle down, and what was once extreme becomes commonplace. And that's my concern, is that, yeah, this is extreme theology. This is theology on the fringe. But, you know, I've been watching this for 20 years, and that fringe theology is now mainstream theology. Christian apocalypticism has been around for well over 100 years, but it's been in the last decade. Maybe the last couple decades, maybe with Reagan in the 80s, you began to see that it made a big move into the mainstream. Apocalyptic Christianity is mainstream Christianity. I mean, there's probably 40 million Americans that, or more, that think Jesus is coming back tomorrow, and that the scriptures are a script, and, you know, it ends with total and complete destruction of this planet, and then, you know, King Jesus comes back and recreates something. So I think that even though some of this rhetoric is extreme, it filters into the main line. Let me give a political example. Scalia, the Supreme Court justice, is a prototype of what this administration likes in a federal judge. And Bush has said that himself. You know, if he's going to appoint Supreme Court justices, he wants to support people like Scalia. Scalia, let me give a quote. He says that government derives its moral authority from God. Government is the minister of God, with powers to revenge, to execute wrath, including wrath by the sword. Scalia is drawing from a passage in Romans chapter 13. And again, I think, in my point of view, would be taking it out of context. But he draws his political philosophy and legitimates his political philosophy through an appeal to a very rigid interpretation of Scripture. And if you look at Romans 13, which Scalia is citing here, where you eventually get to the point of is that all dissent, any dissent, is a form of treason, and any resistance to the good government ordained by God should be prohibited. And Scalia goes on to say that when he looks at the Constitution, again, quote, a direct quote from him, "The Constitution that I interpret and apply is not living, but dead." This is kind of how right-wing Christians read the Scripture. The Bible isn't living. There's no real active dialogue in it. The Scripture that was written 2,000 years ago means today exactly what it meant back then. And so all this grid of interpretation and applying it to society is irrelevant. And so Scalia, the code word here that federal judges like him use, is they want to apply the Constitution in its original intent. Well, again, what that would mean in terms of an original intent is if you go back to the 1700s when the Constitution was written, the death penalty at that time clearly permitted a lot of different forms of death for different kinds of felonies. So much so that if you look back in the law, if horse thievery was a felony, and therefore a person who stole a horse could be killed, well, the original intent of that, well, today if people steal horses, you know, they can be killed. It just takes another step to say there's a precedent for all kinds of felonies, including dissent, accusing someone of witchcraft, accusing someone of adultery or homosexuality or heresy or so forth. As long as you could find a law in 1791 that made those acts a felony, you could say that this implies that it's okay to have a death penalty. In and of itself, that's crazy talk. That doesn't mean much. But what we're seeing in our time is that the growing strength of government, either through the imperial presidency or a Congress or the judicial branch, of having a tighter and tighter stranglehold around the civil rights of the American people. And so I think, although this is extreme rhetoric, I think over time it begins to filter down, and what was once crazy then becomes permissible.
I was checking out Catherine Eureka's website. She writes a lot on the subject. And I was curious if you agreed with this interpretation that the current administration in the White House, in line with the extreme right, believes that the American poor and middle class are beneath them and have earned God's wrath by their lasciviousness and undisciplined lives. That was her quote. Have you read that, and do you agree with that?
You know, I do agree. I think that I agree that within Christian rhetoric and my intuition of this particular administration and the mood of many in the country, and that's what I'm more concerned about, is the character of the American people, is that poverty, those who are poor are blamed for their poverty, that it's somehow their fault that they can't get out of poverty. And again, I think that people are, the American people can still be compassionate. They're willing to offer a hand up. But it's almost as if we look at the poor without the context of how this poverty arises. And we simply think that, okay, we give somebody $100 or we give them a month's rent so they can get on their feet, they'll be on their feet. But if there are no jobs to get on your feet with, and if the jobs that you have are constantly squashing you, again, the lack of meaningful work, the lack of calling out a person's creativity and imagination, the system itself becomes very oppressive. People don't get ahead. They don't see a future for themselves. Again, to get our minds around this, I don't know how anyone can be living in Seattle making less than $50,000 a year. I mean, it's just extremely difficult to live in Seattle for underneath that. And yet, you know, last night I went to a restaurant and I can tell you that the waitress is not making $50,000 a year. As a matter of fact, she's working two jobs, you know, because we asked her. She works during the day at one restaurant, and she worked at this particular restaurant at nights doing banquet service. had I been able to totally interview her, and if I had gotten to know her, my real questions were, how do you have a life? Where is your Sabbath break? Where is your ability to, rejoice in the fruits of your labor? And what I see over and over in the lives of the working class, the working poor, and certainly the homeless, is that there is a lack of a future, and poverty becomes spiritually very demoralizing. I think that factor is overlooked quite often, and that people, even Christians, seem to think sometimes that getting out of poverty is simply a technique. Give them a job at McDonald's and somebody will work themselves out of poverty. And I think it really overlooks the systemic structures of the kind of economy we've created and what it's done to us.
What I found interesting from that section, if it is true that they hold the poor and the middle class beneath them and that those need to be purged, is if you take that in combination with the strategy coming out of some of the groups that are leading this extreme wing, like, for instance, one of the documents from, is it the Free Congress organization, the document, The Integration of Theory and Practice, a Program for a New Traditionalist Movement, where they talk about destroying the infrastructure that we currently have in this country so that they can rebuild it in their own image. So they're talking about that these people are beneath them, yet they are going to destroy the infrastructure that allows these people to survive. So they're essentially creating these people in a way.
Right. But again, in terms of holy war rhetoric, it's tough love. You need to purge the impure and the evil of society for the good of all, so that we can rebuild society, reconstruct society. Dominion theology is called reconstructionism. So you can reconstruct society. And when you reconstruct society, according to the theory, their theories, is that the poor will actually be given a new start, in a sense. And because their moral character will be such that they won't fall into poverty again. It's very utopian kind of thinking. But in many senses, and I perhaps being a little too harsh here, but in many senses, the poor simply don't matter, because God will bless you if you're righteous. And so if you're poor, there's obviously something in your life that has kept you from receiving the blessings of God. And that needs to be corrected. And your eternal soul is far more important than your physical body. And so if your physical body needs to be exterminated, at least your soul can be saved.
We only have about 5 minutes left. So clarify for me, how do these people synchronize what they're doing with the teachings of Jesus? I mean, if Jesus is teaching that, you're supposed to be good to others and...
Well, you'll notice, or you can if you study them, they won't talk about the Sermon on the Mount very much. Matter of fact, they reinterpret the Sermon on the Mount to mean, but to get them off the hook a little bit, I think the vast majority of Christians have reinterpreted the Sermon on the Mount, saying that it was an idealistic ethic and Jesus didn't mean what he said. I personally disagree with that. I think Jesus meant exactly what he said. But the kind of the Dominion branch, and again the extreme right wing, I think continually what we need to keep in mind is that they believe that if our personal character conveys a certain holiness, that and they have a little definition for that, God will bless us. And if the blessing is not there, if something is happening in our family structures, in our personal relationships, in our own prayer life that is causing some dissonance between ourselves and God, that's our fault, and there's obviously some sin, some kind of wickedness in us that needs to be purged out of us. And I think that needs to be kept in mind in dealing with the right-wing church, is it's very much a holiness movement and very much a literal black and white world. You are pure or you're impure. You're moving one direction or the other.
For those people that aren't religious at all, that sit back and hear about the extreme right and then perhaps look at yourself and would just paint you, well, you're one of the extreme left Christians, or, you know, and you're all a bunch of nuts, and why should I worry about this anyway? Because you're a minority group out there. You're, you know, you talk loud, but you're really not affecting things.
I would disagree. I just disagree. I think that Christian rhetoric in this particular culture and this particular country is very much, I mean, leave aside the truth claims. Is it true or is it not? But simply, the Christian rhetoric is behind any politician. They all need, all political movements need some form of sacred transcendence to legitimate their movement. And in this country, that has to come through Christian rhetoric. And I think that's why secular folks who have no connection with the church, and other folks outside of the Christian religion, really do need to pay attention to what's happening in the church. And in that sense, I would draw it's a strained analogy, but I would draw the analogy with Germany and the rise of Hitler and Nazism, which I do equate with this administration and what's happening in our country. But, you know, Hitler also drew upon narratives in Scripture to legitimate his drive towards power. And of course, you know, once he, you know, kind of consolidated that power, that rhetoric got deep-sixed a little bit. But the, you know, another way to look at the history of World War II or the history of the rise of Nazism is to study the church history that was happening in the compromises and how the church reacted to the whole Nazi drive towards power. I do think there's some parallels, and I think the church is worth paying attention to from a strictly secular point of view.
All right. What are some resources people can turn to if they want to find out more about this?
The paper, the talk I give, George Bush and the Rise of Christian Fascism, is on our church's website, and so people can turn to that, because at the end of that paper is some resources, and that would be tumseattle.org, tumseattle.org. And you know, I'm just looking down and realizing I don't have Catherine Eureka, but if you have...
Oh,
you have,
hers is you can go to her website. It's the Eureka Report, Y-U-R-I-C-A report.com.
She's my hero these days. I think she is doing incredible research. There's another one called Theocracy Watch. It's either .org or .com. But Theocracy Watch is another one.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for coming in this morning.
Thanks for having me.
We've just been talking with Reverend Rich Lang. He is pastor at Trinity United Methodist Church in Ballard, and you might know it as one of the churches that you hear some of the fine speakers that come through town. Seattle Thunder does a lot of stuff through that church, so definitely check it out.